Thanks, Martin, and thanks to Cedar for inviting me back this year. With all the grief I've been getting, I must admit I expected Lisa to call me quietly a few weeks ago and say, I'm sorry you can't come. But anyway, I'm delighted to be here. And obviously there'll be some overlap between what I'm going to say and what Tim's already said. Hopefully that won't bore you. It'll just reinforce the message if there is consistency about that. Last year when I actually got up here, it was fascinating because that morning there was a headline in the, I forget which, but basically there was a headline in the Australian saying one thing and a headline in the West Australian saying another. Basically, the world's going to come to an end any moment, and the other was, this is going to go on forever, isn't it fantastic? Unfortunately, because I didn't actually have time to incorporate some press on Saturday this week into my slides, but I did bring along the two headlines, and you probably won't be able to see it all that well, but Saturday's West Business warning bells for a $200 billion slump. And in the Australian that same day, lucky country awash in opportunity. So it's really good because I'd rather they say that than me. I think it's probably best to sort of observe rather than predict. But that's what we've been asked to do today, to sort of observe and predict. And I think the fact that we see that kind of thing happening on a very regular basis, the push and pull of optimism versus pessimism, is probably healthy, and it also means that we are asked every now and then to really think about how long this is all going to go on, as Tim said. Just have to work out. Hopefully you can read that. I just wanted to basically, a bit of an overview, then maybe a kind of inverted triangle, talk about what's happening in the world and then come down to Western Australia without sort of doing too much overlap with what Tim has said, weave in a bit about the markets and commodities and currencies, but also observe a couple of the phenomena, maybe some of which Tim's already talked about, and some others that perhaps are happening around us, but perhaps need a bit more discussion as well. The simple fundamental message of what's going on, I think, at the moment in business anyway around the world, business and markets, is that cheap money equals expensive assets. And really, if you just take that away from today, that's kind of my message. I think that for all sorts of reasons, we'll get to it in a minute, that's been what's been happening in the last year, two, three, and that's why we're seeing such strength in particularly in the West Australian economy, but also around the world. Markets very strong, investors awash with cash, and they're in really, basically, as again we'll talk about later, pushing risk premiums down and asset prices are up across a broad range of asset classes. Hopefully you can read that. Uranium, talking about predictions, I did say last year that I thought uranium and the whole nuclear discussion debate would in fact get a lot more currency, and it did. I think that's going to continue in 07. And as we've already heard from Tim, carbon trading and water, and I do want to say a bit more about those down the track. Commodity prices, there's lots of predictions about where that's going. Essentially, it's around increasing supply, not so much anything to do with demand, and probably a little more steadiness, a little more sort of probably rationality in the commodity markets going forward this coming year. Try the other way. We continue to see two economies in Australia, basically Western Australia and Queensland and the rest of the country. We've seen that Western Australia is incredibly well leveraged to the China boom. You could say the East Asian boom, but certainly we've seen just what impact that's had. We don't hear so much about India these days, but that's still sitting in the background ready to grow very strongly. And so really, again, without going over all the things on the slide, we're really talking about increasing supply of commodities, some easing in the housing market, this whole issue around population growth and what that's going to do, supply and demand of labour. Capacity constraints are something you hear about all the time. They're real, and we do need to do something about the supply of labour. We need to be a bit bolder about that. And uranium and agricultural opportunities. We've seen Western Australia, those of us who've lived here, sort of take some time to really come of age. And it's just fascinating with 2 million people and the size of the place. Everywhere pretty much you look, we're ready and well positioned to benefit from these trends. I've got a chart later on about the rainfall in Western Australia, and I'm a very strong believer in that we can be very bold about positioning ourselves to take great advantage of this climate change that we're talking about. We're just lucky, you know. If you were in a smaller, different place, you just couldn't do it. So it's just another piece of optimism, I guess, for the future. There's no doubt that Australia's been, the rest of the country's been in some slight downturn. Certainly the western suburbs of Sydney, the real estate market, there's actually been quite a lot of retraction in housing prices there, which has had an impact on the wealth effect. But that is offset by the liquidity sitting inside companies. The corporate balance sheets are in very, very good shape. Profits are very strong. And that's actually been able to offset some of the consumer pessimism by the investment in capital goods. Just quickly, kind of separated US and China from the rest of the world. There's obviously been a lot of talk around the housing market in the US having an impact on consumption, and therefore what would that do to Chinese exports and the whole sort of growth in the world economy. I was in China last year, late last year, went to Shanghai and Beijing, and the message you get there is that, sure, the Americans and indeed the rest of the sort of Western world are very important to China in terms of being places for their exports to go. But with so many people moving from the country to the cities in China, there's going to be a very substantial and ongoing demand, domestic demand. And it's something that's easy to forget until you go there and you just see the movement of 300 or 400 million people over the next 10 to 20 years urbanising and consuming, and what that will do vis-a-vis, you know, growth in a mature market like the US. So I came away from China pretty well optimistic. I think there's some real issues around pollution. When you can't see the ground when you're at 3,000 feet coming to land in Beijing, that is a problem. There's obviously some major issues around cost increases. There's still issues around corruption. But basically, you can come away from China feeling pretty optimistic. In the US, yes, there's certainly some slowing. But when you go there, and I was there just a few weeks ago, again, corporate balance sheets are very good, in very good shape. There's good levels of profitability. And sure, the consumers might be a little more subdued, but they're essentially still out and about. So I came away from the US feeling pretty optimistic as well. And of course, now the rest of the world is much more in sync than it's been. When you look at what's even happening in Africa, the strongest growth there for many, many years, obviously on the back of commodity prices again. Eastern Europe continues to perform well, India strong, Middle East, the recycling of petrodollars. So it goes on. So we've actually got a confluence of events when you come back to looking at our position that all play pretty well to an optimistic future. I suppose, want to spend a bit of time on this whole issue of global liquidity because it's having such a major impact on so many areas of economies and commerce. China has, $1 trillion now in reserves. The oil-producing countries are awash in cash. And as I said, the corporate balance sheets are all in pretty good shape too. So what you've had is this enormous amount of liquidity searching for a home. And you've actually had, obviously, a lot of that money channeled into the hands of investment managers, fund managers, who've then obviously gone out looking for returns on behalf of their clients. You've had individuals doing extremely well. You've had very significant amounts of corporate activity, takeovers and the like, and just this enormous amount of cash sloshing around the system and supply and demand, as I said, cheap money, expensive assets. And I guess, you know, as I've said, excessive liquidity, narrowing premiums on riskier assets, that's certainly something we're going to hear a lot about, and we are already, that obviously you have to look forward to some potential for people paying too much for assets, that cash flow falls away and people lose money. But at the moment, what we're finding is that that phenomenon hasn't even started to look like it's going to happen. And so we're seeing more and more really what are being viewed by the observers, the journalists and others as being quite unprecedented. But if you look behind what's causing it, it is largely driven by this liquidity boom. if you look at some of the private equity issues, and there's been a lot spoken of recently about what that's all going to mean, you can in fact, if you can take the emotion out of the debate, see a scenario where something has to give. Either listed companies have to take a different view of governance potentially, of reward of senior management, of acceptable levels of gearing. Because what is happening clearly is that there's one price for a listed company under current structures that we might view as normal, historically normal, and another valuation based on increased gearing, money that has a different view about its return requirements over the medium term, and a different view about how to incentivise management. And as I said, unfortunately, a lot of the discussion gets wrapped up in almost a kind of nostalgic debate about we don't like this change, it's not good, you know, it can't be right, people must be being greedy, you know, rah, rah, rah. But essentially it's just around that view that, as I said, there's two different valuations. And obviously if you can gear something up with the cheap money that's around, you know, you're obviously in a position where you can get a much higher return on the equity that's sitting inside that vehicle. Management is basically a commodity that's in short supply. And so what's happening is people are approaching management and saying, well, you know, what about aligning yourself with this different pool of capital and coming along for a ride? And again, I think people are quite disturbed about that, but at the end of the day, management's entitled to seek the best return for its labour. So I think we're going to see a lot more of that, and I think we're going to have to probably determine quite quickly whether the levels of compliance and in a sense, box ticking is something that is viewed as actually creating value or sustaining value inside a company, which is not to say that obviously you suddenly throw all of the rule books out of out the door. And I think potentially too, the rating agencies and the shareholders of these major listed companies are going to have to think about whether they can actually take a more sanguine view about increased debt to avoid the kind of value gap that we've seen in the companies that I've just got on the list here and many others, leading to this corporate activity and the reduction of the number of large listed companies on the market. You'd imagine the ASX might have something to say about that, because in due course it'll have a significant impact on their revenue as well. But essentially, if you have a belief that these global liquidity surpluses are going to continue for any length of time, supply and demand again, if you believe long-term interest rates are going to stay low, then you will continue to have this phenomenon of capital chasing assets and paying different prices for them to take them into a different structure. Just going back to the US, and I'll go through this as quickly as I can. Essentially, we need to understand the major drivers of the world economies, US and China particularly. And so, yes, it's very important for us to understand what's going on in the US. As I said, I'm pretty relaxed that we're not going to have any major slump or any major dislocating effect there based on everything that you can observe. And indeed, if you're worried about inflation, I think there's a view now that that's something that's easing, and you can feel it when you're there. A lot of talk about this whole twin deficit issue and how long are people going to be prepared to fund what is a pretty scary-looking scenario when you look at it like this. There are some things to consider, though, just the amount of investment that US corporations have made into other jurisdictions where they are producing, whether it's China or Indochina or Eastern Europe, and the way that the repatriation, if you like, of profits is handled can actually have quite an ameliorating impact on this whole deficit issue. And certainly there doesn't seem to be any sign, other than a bit of a drift of investment into euro, that the markets are concerned about this. They've certainly been talking about it for a long time. There's been a lot of discussion about how it's potentially dislocating, but it seems to be that that it's going to continue. While the US economy is in reasonable shape, presumably tax receipts are going to be able to start clawing back some of the fiscal imbalance. We know that China's been a major driver in the world economy. Again, I think we need to look at what the risks are. exchange rate pressures, pressure from other countries who don't like the idea of these ongoing substantial surpluses that are hollowing out manufacturing, and so there'll be some political pressure on a revaluation of their currency. But over time, I think that again can be handled. There are issues around the strength of the banking system. There's issues around pollution, obviously, and some major concern now, and you wouldn't believe it, but in China about having to look at setting up some of their manufacturing in even lower wage environments. But again, I think you can be reasonably confident in the short, medium term. A lot of people say that that nothing's going to happen until after the Olympics, that they're going to showcase their country. 08, up until 08, everything will be fine, and then after that, watch out. You know, I think that's a bit trite. I think that, sure, there might be some opportunity post the Olympics to address some of these structural issues they've got, but I, again, don't see with the demographic and the kind of whole social issue in China working the way it is that you're going to see any major problems. It's always interesting to put charts up about anything to do with China because they're just so amazing, but that steel exports one is really something that's just incredible. And again, if you're a steel exporter, you'd have to just be a little bit concerned that you're just going to get completely squeezed out of the market. Just a quick one on West Australian exports, just to highlight that China is growing significantly in terms of its importance, although still, as we speak, behind Japan, and I'll talk just a little bit about Japan in a minute. The outlook, again, I don't want to spend too much time on it, but the outlook for China looks to me to be pretty favourable. Another one on shipping rates. The shipping rates actually are very volatile and have been used as a predictor of future economic activity in China, and it really isn't playing out all that well. You see the volatility between sort of $2,000 and $6,000, and then, you know, pretty steady 10% growth in China. So if you see that one, it doesn't necessarily mean as much, but the trend is back up again, which would suggest a very healthy level of trade going on. Japan got sort of pushed to the sidelines over the last few years because of that decade-long recession. But if you have a look, you know, Japan is slowly emerging from that, and given the importance of it to us in terms of a trading partner, it's something to consider. But again, if anything is going to contribute to a strong economy in Australia, and particularly in Western Australia. Europe, again, sort of tends to get pushed to the side. They've obviously got some fairly significant issues around productivity. As we saw in France, when the government's trying to do something about that, there's riots in the street, literally. But over time, I think as we had to bite some bullets and go through a lot of pain in the 80s, I think Europe ultimately will have to address some of those issues if it's going to be able to compete going forward. But again, you know, modest growth. It's not a drag on the world economy. The Middle East, of course, again, with enormous surpluses that you're seeing being generated, it's again part of this contributor to global liquidity. I always think going to Dubai is something we should do, just to have a look at what long-term planning can do. You're taking a 20-30-year view and you're saying the source of my income is actually going to change, therefore I need to do something now and reinvest in the future. It's quite a fascinating story, one we can learn. Energy prices, as I said, critical to Australia's economic performance, and indeed I guess any mature economy's performance. A lot of discussion around supply and demand of oil and the tipping point, you know, declining reserves and increasing consumption. The markets do seem to be fairly sensitive to price, though, and indeed I think I saw some stats the other day to say that consumption of oil had actually levelled off for the first time in a very long time, notwithstanding this level of economic activity. So there is substitution going on, and that will continue. A lot of talk about the price heading back up towards $100 a barrel in the next couple of years. I guess that's going to depend a lot on the strength of the economies and indeed any moves to sort of encourage green type alternatives. And we'll talk about that in a minute as well. I think this whole issue around uranium, it's a very difficult one, because obviously, especially those of us who are a bit older, remember the heat in the argument back in the 70s. But I think if governments are listening to the population, they are effectively hearing nothing of that kind of heat that used to be around 20, 30 years ago. And so what you have to really think about, I suppose, is what's the practical impact of something like a ban on uranium mining in Western Australia when indeed it's allowed in other parts of the country? And the practical impact is that you're effectively stifling economic activity. And what's the reason you're doing it? Well, it's ideology, I guess. So I guess I feel a bit sympathetic to this Labor administration, because it carries, you know, I guess from a long time back, a kind of ideological position on uranium mining. But given the amount of reserves Western Australia has, and given the aforementioned things Tim was talking about in terms of addressing some of the green issues, it really seems to me to be inevitable, and that we're, I suppose you could argue, being fined by an ideological position that really, I don't think, has the heat in it that perhaps it did 20, 30 years ago. And it would be interesting to see what a poll would say if people were asked about how they felt about uranium mining in Western Australia, given the fact that it's obviously occurring elsewhere in the country. Now, I'm not saying that you get the same response if you asked whether they wanted a nuclear reactor or somewhere nearby, but I think, you know, we need to understand the world moves on, and that clinging to potentially historically outdated ideological positions are not necessarily doing the right thing for the population. So I actually do believe over time pragmatism will prevail, and that you will see uranium mining open up here. I certainly think there's no reason why it shouldn't. I think we can all benefit from it. Down the track, well, maybe 20, 30 years, we might be talking about the nuclear generation of electricity, but that's a different story altogether. And if you wanted to be really controversial, you know, the deserts in the middle of the country are probably not bad repositories for waste. You know, it's just a question of getting over a kind of, again, an ideological position. But if we're going to export, we probably need to be taking a non-hypocritical position about taking waste back and making a business out of it. So I think uranium is going to continue to be a major story in 07 and forward. And green and global warming issues, obviously it's delightful. Well, it's not delightful. It's very gratifying to see that we're now finding mainstream acceptance on both sides of the political fence about the issues, and that Al Gore's work and others is actually being recognised as valid, and we don't have any of this kind of misinformation swirling around. It's more everyone being now aligned to sort it out. And obviously, in sorting it out, there'll be a number of business opportunities, whether it's getting involved in carbon trading or whether it's actually developing sort of green alternatives, energy or electricity generation, moves to sort of recycling, I think is all very good news. Just to chop back into the issues around commodities and global liquidity again, it's just been absolutely fascinating to see the involvement of the hedge funds in the movements of commodity prices, and that's why we've seen so much volatility. I think that we're going to continue to see that. And there's obviously this extra element now, not just demand from industry, but demand from speculators who will get on a trend and ride it hard. And that's why you're going to continue to see quite a lot more volatility in commodity prices, because of that extra element. It's been quite remarkable to have a look at that sort of flat period for so long, and then this dramatic increase in the prices of some very important commodities to us, nickel being one in particular, and obviously what's happened to some of the stocks who've been exposed to them. It's there's a view that as I said earlier, as supply increases, so some of these forward estimates about prices of commodities will fall away. And I'm a subscriber to that, but I don't see any sustained collapse in some of the commodity prices. I think there's just too much underlying demand. And it does take a long time for production to come on stream. And someone was talking about a mine that was due to open in Canada in the next 2 or 3 years. It just got delayed another 3 or 4 years beyond that. And so you're going to see a lot of that that sort of setback of increased production, even though we are seeing a bit of it happening here, which will obviously have an impact on prices. Continuing to talk about demand, as I said, I think you'll see some potential speculative-related falls, but I think underlying demand is going to stay pretty strong. So, again, for us, very important that the outlook for commodities, having been as strong as it is, isn't suddenly going to fall away. It's possible that softening prices, if they were sustained, would lead to some easing in investment, but I think what we're seeing, and Tim touched on it, is there's so much commitment now to increase production that even if there was a short-term impact, the money's committed, it can't be stopped and turned off just like that. So I'm expecting that that we'll continue to see significant investment that that's going to go on for at least the next 2 or 3 years to bring new production on. The two economies I talked about, you know, we've seen happen now for, I mean, it's been a recurrent theme now for 3 or 4 years since the commodity prices started to pull away, which is not to say that the economy in the rest of the country is actually that weak. It obviously has been impacted on by the housing slump, but most sort of areas of the economy seem to be doing pretty well, as evidenced by the profitability of Australian listed companies and indeed the move in the share price, whether it's financial services or transport or, you know, any number of sectors that you can look at that would otherwise potentially be impacted by a sort of slowing of economic growth, they seem to be doing pretty well. This whole issue around labour here, though, again, it's a bit like uranium. You know, we're stuck with, an ideological position that potentially is past its use-by date. And yes, we're getting quite a lot of guest worker type immigration, and we heard from Tim that that you know we're getting more than our share of net overseas migration. But I mean, I'm on the board of Austal. We've got quite a few Filipinos now working there. It's been a real success story. They're getting paid 10 times what they'd be paid back in the Philippines. They're being paid what their co-workers are being paid. And they've integrated into the community and into the company extremely well. If that hadn't happened, there'd be some 300 or 400 positions that would still be looking for people to fill, and that there'd be a commensurate reduction in output and difficulty in terms of meeting production schedules. So it's a very practical example of how this can work, and I'd certainly implore our political leaders to except that while we're going to continue to see this level of economic activity, while we're continuing to talk about a base of 2 million people exposed to this enormous level of opportunity, that we need to be as, I guess, optimistic about an immigration program that brings skilled people in from elsewhere as we can be, and not be too tied up in a potentially historically outdated ideological position. I talked just at the bottom here briefly about stalled reforms. I think if you have a look at those, particularly, say, utilities that have been privatised and how well they've done, you'd encourage the New South Wales government particularly to be thinking more about reforms in power. It's still the major state, and it still has the opportunity to unlock a huge amount of value that we've seen in other parts of the country by reforming those particular areas that tend to be run less efficiently under public ownership than they would be under private. I totally endorse what Tim said about the pricing of water. We're not going to get proper investment in what is a relatively simple thing, if you think about it, to solve in the water area until we price water accordingly. It is way, way too cheap. And it's actually differentially priced as well. That effectively industry gets access to water way, way too cheaply, but so do we as consumers. And I think that once you start talking about recycling, once you start talking about effectively more bold solutions, as it were, I think you'll start to see that the shortage of water is actually a bit of a myth. There's plenty of water, it's just not priced properly, and there's no incentive to in fact bring more of it on stream. Yep, sure, sorry. I'm just going to go quickly through all of this. Global indices, we've done very well in the market, obviously as a result of some reforms that occurred many, many years ago, but also more recently what's been happening in the commodity sector. Our currency's been strong, which is obviously good and bad. Good if you're an exporter, not too good if you're an importer. Sorry, other way around. We've had quite interesting, if you have a look at the performance of some major stocks in the market, they've actually been quite flat. If you have a look forward and you're talking about the markets and where they're going, you'd have to assume that the markets ultimately will recognise that things have been going pretty well. BHP's buyback, a huge buyback announced the other day on the back of record profits, has got the stock up a bit, but it really hasn't done much at all. When you compare it to some other stocks that we can put up, it really has, it's been pretty flat, as have Rio and some of the other major companies. So I'm expecting that some of those majors are actually going to get re-rated over the next few months, and people will just generate that they will accept that they're just cash generators, cash generating machines, and they'll be either buying stock back and putting cash into the hands of the shareholders or paying substantially increased dividends. Just a couple of individual stocks here too, exposed to nickel, to uranium, to zinc, and iron ore in the case of Fortescue. Obviously, some particular stocks have just performed unbelievably. Now, you won't see those kinds of performances going forward, but I think you're also not going to necessarily see things just sort of fall away either. Just got a couple of mining services companies, which is the other area that's done pretty well. And, you know, we've been, again, fortunate to have some of these companies in Western Australia. This whole issue about a $200 billion slump. This time last year, the markets were very strong. They continued on for a while, and then we had quite a dramatic pullback in May that lasted for a while. Everyone thought, oh, it's all over, and, of course, then made new highs. The prediction of a pullback, yeah, sure, you can always have a 10-15% pullback. It's probably quite healthy. But it's worth reflecting on the fact that the average price-earnings ratios over the last, say, 5 years or so have been about 17.9%. Going forward into 07 at 16.3. That doesn't suggest a dramatically overvalued market, in my view. I don't want to spend any time on this. We've already seen it. But I think, again, just a story that suggests Western Australia is in very good shape. Property outlook, again, slow down for sure after a huge increase in prices. But again, just that level of population influx is creating significant demand, and I think I'm not expecting, again, any dramatic fall. I think, just as Tim said, perhaps a reduction in volume, not so much a fall away in prices. Unemployment rate is way, way down. It plays to the point we made earlier about importing labour. The rainfall statistics are something that really are quite fascinating. You can feel it happening. It's real. We need to transition our agriculture as much as we can up to where it actually rains and will rain on a regular basis going forward. I continue to look at that coastline, that 2,000-3,000-mile coastline, and suggest that there are all sorts of places along there where there's abundance of sun, good soil, energy close by, just add water. And, you know, sure, maybe when you price a pipe or a canal to take water from the Kimberleys to Perth and you don't look at the value you can add along the way, it doesn't look like it's viable. But down the track, that vast coastline can spawn cities like Palm Springs or like Phoenix, Arizona. There's no reason why that can't happen at all. Just a quick one on stocks again. The government giveth and the government taketh away. We just saw in the last few days Timbercorp and Great Southern being dramatically knocked around by some changed government policy, which is already being talked about being overturned. But just beware of companies where you're relying on government support incentives or some kind of tax break for them to their continued viability or profitability, because governments can be quite fickle. Economic growth, Tim talked about that, just really confirming that things are looking pretty good going forward. And just to recap, sure, the economic growth for the world is slowing down a little bit because of the US, but no major cause for alarm. Australian growth is steady at 2.5, 2.8. There's so much liquidity, though, buybacks, dividend increases, corporate activity, private equity, that you can imagine that that liquidity will continue to to drive a fairly strong stock market. Western Australia is going to remain strong because of China and the other factors we talked about. Remember that booms sometimes end with no warning, but that didn't happen in 87 or in 2000. Everyone knew the markets were grossly overvalued. I just don't think they are at the moment. I think that we're still in reasonably neutral territory in that regard. And I guess the only other thing is just make sure that we're as bold as we can be, that we think we're doing really well. We're never going to know how well we could have done if we don't take some fairly bold initiatives. We're perfectly positioned, and we should continue to reflect on that, not be satisfied with what is obviously extremely good performance when indeed we could be doing better again and investing for the sort of 10, 20 year horizon. So thanks for that. Sorry I've taken more time than I should have.